Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. Today we will talk about gender equality in politics and government. Women have made considerable progress in the United States. Nancy Pelosi became the first female Speaker of the House. Hillary Clinton became a U.S. Senator and Secretary of State and is now a front runner for president. But despite these famous females, women still only hold 24% of state offices and only 18% of federal offices. After slow progress up to the 1990s, the number of women serving in office has plateaued for the past 20 years. Despite growing acceptance of women in office, men still hold over 80% of the seats in the U.S. House and Senate. Although we think of the U.S. as a world leader for women's rights, in fact, a world ranking of women in national legislatures shows the U.S. ranks only 83rd in the world for percentage of women in national office, behind Bangladesh and Bolivia. Even at the state level, the pipeline from which most federal candidates emerge, men still hold over 75% of the seats. Why are women in the U.S. still so far from gender equality among office holders? What difference does it make that men still dominate the political sphere? And what can we do to have equal representation of women in office? Here to help us understand this and answer these questions is Cynthia Terrell, a founder of Fair Vote, whose mission is to make democracy fair, functional, and representative through structural reforms in our voting system. She is currently chair of Representation 2020, a project of Fair Vote which focuses on structural solutions to address the underrepresentation of women in elected office. Ms. Terrell has also served as a board member of several charitable organizations, notably the American Friends Service Committee. Before co-founding Fair Vote, Ms. Terrell worked extensively as a political consultant around the country, as campaign manager and field director for campaigns for the U.S. President, U.S. House and Senate, for governor, and for state and city initiatives. Ms. Terrell is a mother of three children and a graduate of Swarthmore College with a B.A. in political science. Cynthia Terrell, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks, Eleanor.
So this is going to be fun. I so admire and appreciate the work that you're doing now and that you've done for years to help make democracy fair and representative. Let's start by addressing a question. Why does it matter that men hold 75% of the elected positions? And what difference would it make if we had more women in elected office?
Well, that's a great place to start. Thank you. The fact of the matter is that women are 51% of the population, as I think we can all agree. And the early founders of this country talked a lot about Congress and legislative bodies being an exact portrait of the people in miniature. That's the famous line. And I think that's the spirit that motivates us, that in order for democracy and decision-making bodies to thrive, everybody has to have a seat at the table. And currently, we're leaving out some of our best and our brightest voices from the table of decision making. So I think it from a philosophical point of view about the undergirdings of our democracy, I think it just makes sense that everybody has to have a seat at the table and a voice in the decision making process.
So it's a combination of this is real democracy to have everybody that's paying our taxes to be fairly represented. It's
yes.
A matter of fairness, and it's also it's like a talent pool that's not being fully drawn on to help us with good governance.
Exactly. And I think
we could all agree that we need some help there to make our democracy working better. Yes.
Exactly. It's interesting to think of the kinds of representation that we all agree on. We think that, you know, every state has representation, every geographic area has representation. So we've gone to some lengths to ensure that there's one person, one vote, and so forth and so on. So I think that's all very important. it connects to another point, which I think there's more and more evidence about the specific role that women can play as good negotiators in these tough bipartisan times of acrimony, that there's more and more evidence that people like Susan Collins and Barbara Mikulski and other women who are both Republicans and Democrats play a particularly unique role in being able to work across the aisle and consider co-sponsoring legislation and really having their eye on the prize of moving the ball forward for everybody. And they seem to have a track record so far of being able to go out on the limb for one another.
Well, we sure saw that last year when the Congress brought the U.S. government and economy to the brink. We're saying, well, the Republicans were saying we're not going to raise the debt ceiling limit and couldn't agree on a budget to keep the government going. And
exactly.
And it was U.S. Senator Patty Murray got together with a Republican colleague and said, let's get this worked out. And they hammered out an agreement that then became what did actually pass. So it'd be nice if we had some more of that attitude at the table to get the job done and really take care of the people's business instead of all this grandstanding.
Exactly, exactly.
So I mentioned in the introduction to this show about the current state of women's representation in U.S. elected office. You know, where do you see that we're at right now?
Well, according to the Interparliamentary Union, which is the worldwide group that tracks women's representation globally, the United States ranks behind 95 countries in the percentage of women in our national legislature, in our lower house. And so that's pretty far behind. And not only are we far behind other countries, we're falling behind at a faster rate. So in the year 2000, I think we ranked 58th or so. And it's a reflection part of a longer conversation. Partly we keep doing the same things we've been doing to elect more women and hoping those approaches will work. But the other side of the story is that other countries are innovative and experimental and trying out a number of different approaches to electing more women.
Yeah, we're not great, and we're falling behind. And
exactly.
I just returned from a week in Iceland where I spoke at a conference celebrating 100 years of women having the right to vote. It was really so amazing listening to the women from Iceland and the other Nordic countries talk about the progress that they've made over the past 100 years to get to where they're at. And you know, a lot of these Nordic countries have over 40% of women in parliament.
Right.
And we're less than half of that here.
Yeah.
So you know, what's going on? What do you see that's worked in other countries that is helping to elect more women? Is it anything that can help us here in the U.S.?
Well, that's a great question. For sure, it's a combination of things. And some of it is attitudinal and cultural, and who knows, maybe those cold Arctic nights have some impact that we all need to go study. Who knows? I'll be glad to go and check it out. But the thing that there's a collection of things that we have identified from some several years of research here at Fair Vote and Representation 2020 around some structural and some rule changes and differences that they have. They recruit women candidates more intentionally, so that's part one. They have different voting systems that are based on the principle of proportional representation. That's two. And they also look at procedures within a legislative body to make sure they facilitate women serving and leading effectively. So those include things like childcare and telecommuting and, making sure there's easy access to bathrooms and all kinds of things. So those are internal things they've adjusted to make sure that women can serve and lead.
Yeah, those sound great. So why can't we do that here?
We can. We just haven't tried hard enough yet. But I'm rolling up my sleeves right now. We can. I mean, that's the exciting thing. I guess that's the perennial optimist in me, but I think that we can do those things, and if we set our minds to it, if we have some sense more of these structural things that address the systems that are obstacles to women's representation, that to me feels like an easier lift than changing attitudes or norms. And as I think it avoids the, I think, somewhat slippery slope, I guess I'll say, of assuming somehow that the individual women need to change. There are not enough resources in this country to nurture the self-esteem of each individual person, and in fact, that's not the the most effective way to change the situation. The most effective thing is to say, wow, there are some serious structural obstacles that we see really impede women's electoral success. We've seen that in other countries when they've addressed those structural obstacles, the percent of women has dramatically increased, and that's true in the United States as well. Some of these voting system changes that I mentioned really have had an impact on women's representation. So we see quite clearly that they have an impact.
Yeah, very much so. And it's interesting to me that a lot of the discussion around the lack of women's representation in elected office kind of comes down to some version of blame the victim. That,
yes.
women don't think we're smart enough or that we have the skills, we're experienced enough. And you really have to wonder how true is that after we had George W. Bush as president. How could anyone think they lacked the skill or ability to be president after he made his run there?
So, but, well, that's true.
Yeah, we don't want it to be a kind of a blame the victim situation here. And,
right.
And I'm looking at the women that I was meeting from Iceland and other Nordic countries, and they're, the women I know in the United States are certainly as smart or as self-confident or as unsmart or unself-confident as those women. And yet there they are up at the 40% plus level, and here we are stuck at 18%
exactly.
In our Congress. So
right.
I just, that whole argument that it's women lack the self-esteem or confidence in their own ability certainly is not the whole picture, even though it may be an element there. And I really appreciate you looking at the context in which individual women make decisions about whether to run or not to run or how much support is there once a woman does run. So I appreciate your focus on the structural issues.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I think one context to think of this conversation in is the fact that the United States has a great track record of addressing structural barriers. We adopted Title IX when we realized, wow, there are some serious structural barriers to women having equal access to education. We leveled the playing field for women in education and athletics. And we adopted the Americans with Disabilities Act because there were structural barriers to people with various disabilities fully participating. We're still, I think, hammering a lot of those access issues out, whether it's relating to voting or transportation and other things, but we recognize those structural obstacles and we sought to address those. Similarly, in the era of the voting rights struggles in the 1960s, we recognized that there were structural obstacles, and still are, to people of color getting elected, and so we created a solution, which I think can be approved upon, but we created a solution to address the structural obstacles that people of color faced and face today. So I think that same spirit can motivate us to realize, wow, there really are some structural obstacles to women getting elected. It's not all women's responsibility somehow to, as you say, just feel better about themselves. And it's not that's even if we were able to somehow miraculously to reach every young girl and young woman in this country, there are still going to be structural obstacles to their getting elected. So that has led us to this focus on these rules and structure changes.
Yeah, I think that's so smart and strategic of you to have that kind of a focus. And just as a little more context for this conversation, at the current rate of change, if we kept going the way we're going now, when would women in the U.S. reach gender parity?
Well, drum roll, please. I think, shockingly, we will not reach parity.
Never?
Well, according to our models, I would say, backing up for a second, if you were to say, well, what's a good definition of gender parity? I would say, gender parity really requires women to be represented across this country. That means in every state and across political parties. That means within the Republican Party, within the Democratic Party, and that means in our lifetimes, ideally. And at the current rate of change, it just isn't going to happen. It's too simplistic to somehow think that we're going to be making the same kind of progress that we made when women were just jumping into office in the early 90s. In fact, the data show that not only have we regressed in the state legislative level, which is the major, of course, proving ground for women who then in turn run for higher office, but that in some places, in some states, women are just so far behind, there's been no progress at all. So I think absent serious structural intervention, we will not reach gender parity in this country, certainly not in our lifetimes.
Wow. So, yeah, and, you know, as I talked about earlier, we made some progress there, slow as it was, from 1970s, 80s, into the 1990s, and then it just kind of stopped and in some places slid backwards.
Exactly. So, there was a great quote by a parliamentarian from Canada after last week's election there saying, gender parity doesn't happen by chance. It's not something that's just going to occur if we simply just keep doing what we're doing. Like, we're just not on that trajectory. And though she said that about Canada, I think the same is true of the United States. And in fact, the progress that's been registered in all those other countries reflects a great deal of focus and intention on the part of women and the men who support women having a level playing field. So it took a lot of effort, I think, in those other countries, but I think we can exert that same effort here.
Right. So clearly, if we keep going the way we're going, we're going to, you know, stagnate or lose ground. We'll never reach the goal of gender parity. So we need a game changer. What's our game changer?
Well, I'm not promising the only game changer, but a component of the game plan are the following three things. I referenced them earlier, but I'll talk about each of them a little bit more. One is the way that we recruit candidates. Currently, I would say it's rather haphazard who gets recruited and how they get trained and supported. And there are some fabulous training groups out there who recruit candidates. Close the Gap California and Ignite and Emerge and Running Start and Vote Run Lead and Emily's List all do a great job, but it's not a systematic approach. And the proposal that we have is that political parties be charged with adopting a certain target for the number of women candidates they run, particularly in open seat races where their chances of winning are that much greater. So a political party might set a target at 50%, or they might set an even higher target. And these are voluntary targets. They're not mandatory, though 100 nations in this great world of ours do have some kind of a mandated set of targets for women serving, either it's in their constitution or it's in, their legislature has adopted it. But we are proposing targets that parties set that don't have to be permanent, but that would help up the numbers of women who are being recruited by parties. And one of the things I like to point out when I'm talking about this is that it's actually the Republican Party who led the way in this sense of gender parity in the last century. It was in the teens that the Republican Party said, hey, the leadership of these state party committees is so important, we're going to have them gender balanced so that they alternate man, woman on all the state committees. And the Republicans led the way, and the Democrats...
When was that?
That was in the 19-teens.
So you're talking like 100 years ago.
In order to stay competitive, realized like, wow, we better do this too. And so till this day... But all state party committees are gender balanced, and the committee men and women are positions that people are appointed to or run for, I guess as the case may be, and they're all alternating by gender. So we have a history of talking about gender and acknowledging that something had to be done to ensure that there was gender balance. And so I think that's good to remember, that the Republicans really led the way all through the last century, really into the 1970s or 80s, they were quite likely to be the party who first led on pushing women. Women, GOP women, did quite well in the West, in some of the Western states. And so, but I guess the thing that I would emphasize about this recruitment strategy, and this has certainly been true, in fact, I believe this was true in Iceland, though you can correct me on this, that they had some rules that they adopted that have now been phased out because they were so successful they didn't need to do them anymore. There were simply enough women got to be elected that I think they didn't need to have a women's party anymore in Iceland, and I think that's been true in several other Nordic countries as well. There's a sense, I think, both in the private sector and in the public sector, that it takes about 30% to begin to really have an impact. So once women are 30% of a corporate board or of a legislative body, that's when they can really begin to have a legacy, as it were, and help pull other women up and change some of these internal rules that make it more likely for women to serve and lead effectively. So that's as an interim goal, that 30% is something we're striving for.
Yeah, I think that's a good goal. And yes, it was interesting to me looking at the kind of the history of women in Iceland and how they got there, because the experience of women in Iceland is very much parallel to the experience of women in the U.S. You know, a lot of the kind of gender-defined roles, the lower income jobs and the pay gaps and lack of political representation. Until in the 1970s, there was this kind of awakening there, as there was here. But the difference being in Iceland, what the women did is they did form this women's party, and they had a big push to elect women, and including, by the way, the first woman president of Iceland, who I'm told is the first woman elected by the people of any country in the world.
Mm.
President Vigdis, who I actually had the pleasure of meeting when I was up there.
Oh, neat.
But it was, you know, then so she was elected president and became the longest-serving president of Iceland ever. She was in for 20 years. And it gave a lot of other women inspiration to see her at the top. And then, as you're talking about, setting certain percentages, you know, we want to have 40% of the slates that the parties put forward as candidates to be women. And that's what gave the big boost. But have any of the parties here, I know you talk about the Republicans 100 years ago, said we want to get more women candidates, but has any party in the U.S. ever put a percentage on that? Like, we want to have 30 or 40% women recruited to run?
Not that I've heard. I've done some preliminary research on that just to see if there was some particularly successful story out there that I could be touting, and
yeah.
I haven't seen a mention of that yet, but that's one of those areas which I'd like to really understand better, so that I can see, you know, if there is some local party who's pushing that. I think there are lots of efforts being done, but it's, or there may be conversations like this, particularly at the local level, but it's certainly not, it's not very organized, and I think that hard targets aren't set. And I think because in some respects we've let parties off the hook, we don't really pressure them because we haven't really organized that movement yet to say to the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, all right, we care about women's representation, we want to set a target of 30% for the year 2020 and 40% for the year 2030, and by 2050 we want to have, you know, we want you to be recruiting 50% women candidates in the race, in the seats that you can. And once we've done that, then it will be easier to hold parties accountable when they don't do that. But we
right.
certainly need to have to begin the conversation and start the pressure from within and from without, I think.
Right, I think that's right. I don't think it ever would have happened in Iceland without the outside pressure of the women saying to the party leaders, you have to put the women candidates on there. So we need that outside pressure here. So we know part of our game-changing plan is to recruit more women. What else do we need to do to change the game here?
Another idea that we've had, given that funding of women candidates is so critically important, and I think the perception of needing money is almost as important as the reality of needing money, frankly, That we are working currently on a project around the top political action committees and donors, and very much in the same manner of the political parties, tasking or challenging PACs to also set targets for the amount of money that they give. So the Center for Responsive Politics has shared with us some of their data on giving patterns by gender for the last two election cycles, for 2012 and 2014. And we'd like to use that to formulate a campaign around pressuring those PACs to also set a target, particularly for the open seat races they're supporting candidates in. So whether it's the firefighters or a focus on the family or whatever the PAC might be, they would set a target that felt right to them. And then, again, we could measure progress and see if they've held to it. And I think particularly this is one of those areas that once some PACs begin to really embrace this conversation about gender and supporting women candidates on a level playing field, I think the contagion effect will really pay off, that all PACs will realize, wow, that's an important conversation to be having, and there are some things that we can do that level the playing field, and it's not just a partisan issue. We're not just pushing Democratic candidates to do this or PACs on the right to do this, but we're really pushing everybody to do what they're able to do. I think that's an important part of the strategy as well.
Yeah, that would be great, you know, because money, as we know, is just the mother's milk of running for office now.
Indeed.
And we've got to make sure that women do have money, although it is interesting to me, when women do run, women tend to win at the same rates as men. So
I know. I think that's very interesting. I guess that gets to that misperception that women may be less willing to run or consider running because they think that it's harder to raise the money, or they've been almost schooled to think they're less capable of raising the money, even though, as you say, the data is clear that when women run, they do win at the same rate as men.
Yeah, so that's very encouraging. And another structural reform you mentioned, which really hit home to me when I was up there in Iceland, was this issue of having affordable, quality child care. That, you know, having that policy in place where women have the child care just is so freeing for them to go to work, to go to school, to run for office, to be in office, you know, things that are so enormously stressful for mothers, for women here in the U.S. And it's just, you know, obviously it's parenting is challenging no matter where you are, but there's so much less stress around that whole set of issues for the women there that, you know, it'd be interesting to see what difference would affordable quality child care make.
Yeah.
And well, paid family leave make for women.
We like to think of that as our Paul Ryan proposal, because he's just raised the focus on the fact that men also want to spend time with their children, which we want to encourage and think is a great thing. And so, in fact, I think the child care issue really would have an impact on women's ability to run and serve, but it really will have an impact on men's ability, of course, too. That you know, there are lots of families who are doing that juggle, and so we think childcare and telecommuting and really just moving into this new millennium of ours in terms of technological capacity is just an obvious thing that we have to address.
Right, and I am so happy that Paul Ryan made clear he really wants to spend time with his family and not be on the road all the time working as Speaker of the House. And I find it interesting that he understands at a personal level how valuable that is to him and his family, and yet he staunchly opposes having paid family leave, paid sick leave for women in the country, and men also.
Yes.
So I'm hoping this experience might change his view on that important issue, but I'm not holding my breath.
I guess we'll see. Time will tell.
Time will tell, but I think it's such a model. When you talk about the men also stepping up and parenting, they have a thing now in some of the Nordic countries where, I forget the exact amount, but it's basically whatever the paid leave is, say it's a year, they have paid family leave when there's a new child either adopted or born into a family, and one-third of it must be used by the woman, one-third of it must be used by the man, and one-third of it they can decide however they want to divvy it up.
How interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting because one of the things is in the places where there is paid family leave in this country, it's almost always taken by women, and women are reluctant to use it because it kind of marks them on some kind of a mummy track and that they're not as serious about their work as the men who keep, you know, grinding away day after day.
Mm-hmm.
So the women, even though they legally can access it, they choose not to because it's too high a price to pay with their colleagues and with their reputation. But by mandating that the men also take the parental leave, it kind of takes the stigma out of it. And that mandating it must be used. It's like, okay, and now I'm just following the rules. It's not that so I think, you know, there's some modifications we might look at here in the United States that could really make that a more powerful tool for helping women and men be better parents and better at work.
Absolutely. I agree completely.
So we've got our recruiting more women. We have getting donors to give more money to women. We have childcare, telecommuting. Is there anything else you think we need to do to elect more women in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that the recruitment obviously really is geared toward making sure that more women can run, and the internal legislative measures are really geared toward making sure that women can serve and lead effectively, and that involves, of course, also how women get to how committee leadership is chosen and so forth. Those are sort of the bookends to our proposal. And then the middle part of the proposal, the tofu of the proposal, if you will, in the middle, is, are the voting systems themselves. And we've that's the work that FairVote has done the most focus on, and, where we see the most promise in some senses, because the results are so dramatic. The vast majority of those 95 countries that rank above the United States in the percentage of women, above the United States, used a different philosophy of voting in their voting system. And that same philosophy is used in different ways in the United States. And the results in the United States have also been clear that, wow, women get elected at a much higher rate with a different voting system. So that's the central core part of our reform message.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, what kind of a voting system reform do you propose? Like, what do we have to do differently?
Well, there's some different steps. There are 10 states in this country that currently elect more than one person from any given geographic area for their state legislature. Maryland is one of them. That's why I'm a voter in Maryland. And I elect 3 delegates and 1 state senator, all from the same geographic district. And it turns out that women not only run, but get elected in higher numbers from multi-winner districts. And there may be a range of reasons for that. Part of it is that women may be more likely to run if they are running as part of a team. It may be that parties feel more pressure to nominate some women to be part of that team, as it would look awfully bad, I think, to have 4 men running in the same district. So there's that pressure as well. But those multi-winner districts can have disastrous consequences for people of color unless you add in a system of voting called ranked choice voting, which is used in a range of localities and jurisdictions in this country. And that ensures that all voices are heard, and even non-traditional candidates can have a shot at winning. And just to give you an example of where that's worked well, I could talk about Minneapolis, which is a great example of a city that has ranked choice voting. They elected their mayor, Betsy Hodges, with ranked choice voting. And in ranked choice voting systems, from the voter's perspective, it's very straightforward. You rank your candidates in order of preference, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And the last place finishers are eliminated, and the second place votes of those finishers are redistributed until somebody has won a majority. And the fact of that voting system has some pretty clear positive impacts on elections.
Slow down here just for our listeners who never heard about ranked choice voting, which I think is most people.
I'm sure, yes.
It's not very widely practiced in the U.S. So I'm a voter. I go into the voting booth, and I get to say, here's my top five choices. Like, I want to vote. Number one would, you know, be Cynthia Terrell. Number two would be Hillary Clinton. Number three would be Elizabeth Warren. So I say, okay, those are my choices. And if you're saying, if my number one choice, like if Cynthia Terrell, then my number one choice comes out on the low end of the total votes, then that gets not counted and it reverts to my number two choice. So then Hillary Clinton would get my vote in the next round of counting. Is that right?
Exactly.
Okay, so you just keep going down until there's someone who gets a majority.
Exactly. So, of course, in some races, somebody has a clear majority, 50% plus one to begin with, in which case that person's elected.
Right. Yeah.
So that's in the context of when we're just electing one person, a mayor or a governor or a president, an executive of any kind. And some of the benefits of that system are that candidates have every reason to talk to every voters and to stay positive when they're having that conversation, because if they're out campaigning, they want to get second place votes and third place votes from their opponent supporters. So the campaigns that have used this system are much more positive, and that seems to be what the voters really want. The voters want candidates who are working together and seeking consensus and reaching out to more voters. And then from the once elected, Betsy Hodges has a great line about governing for the whole city, because she knows she represents the whole city. And another feature of the campaign process is that in terms of what the money is spent on in elections is really the negative advertising. That's the thing. It sort of makes sense. You know, it takes a lot of money to convince somebody that somebody who's probably a pretty decent person actually has some terrible or sordid past or something questionable about them. But if you remove the incentive for doing that, then campaigns just cost less money, and Betsy Hodges was outspent but was able to win without running any negative ads, and she really stayed positive. And her philosophy was that I had every reason to reach out to every voter. Like, every voter was a potential vote for me, and that changes the dynamic of how candidates campaign and how voters participate in the process, we think, in pretty important ways for everybody involved, not just for women.
Yeah, that sounds great. I like this ranked choice voting approach. How extensively used is it, like, in the country now?
It's used in four cities in the Bay Area, and in Minneapolis, and in St. Paul, Minnesota, and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or a version of it is there. It's used in Portland, Maine, and it's actually on the ballot in 2016 in Portland, Maine as well for all races. So we're pretty excited about that.
When you say Bay Area, you mean the San Francisco Bay Area?
Yeah, and in fact, just a good stat is of the, I think there are 52 seats that are elected with ranked choice voting in the Bay Area and in four cities there, and I think 48 are held by non-traditional candidates or candidates of color. So that's a pretty marked increase.
Yeah. So it is possible, and it's happening now. So how do we get more of this ranked choice voting to happen? Is this something that's decreed by the state government, or is it on the ballot by cities, or how do we do it?
Well, one thing that's true about this great democracy is there are a lot of different jurisdictions, and so jurisdictions can vary one from another, and a state can set rules for some cities in a state and that don't apply to cities in that same state. But most cities have the capacity to have a charter review process or some kind of a task force on elections, and that's where we've seen this change be most effective, when there's a group of people on the ground who really want to address all the issues that are that we've been talking about, they come together and they have a good network or team of different constituencies represented at the table for reform, and it can either be legislated, it can be put on the ballot, or the charter committee can simply agree that they're going to use ranked choice voting in the next election, and that's how it's been implemented. Or adopted. We've had, it's been a little slow to be implemented everywhere, just ironing out the hardware for voting, the machines actually used to vote. So that's been something that we really have made a lot of progress on. The other way that these systems sometimes come into play is in the course of a Voting Rights Act case, a judge can recommend that a locale use these systems because they tend to do such a good job representing people of color and different constituencies, particularly when you're electing more than one person in a district, you can have representation of more groups of people or types of people, and they can define themselves instead of having a consultant tell them what kind of a district they live in. Or as we like to say, we used to like to say that legislators were choosing their constituents, and now we feel the evidence is pretty clear that consultants who are drawing these lines are picking the constituents for the legislators. So it's even one step removed from the voters in most areas.
So are these the kinds of voting systems reform that you're working on with Representation 2020, or what's your goal with Representation 2020?
Well, our goal for Representation 2020 is to raise awareness of these structural changes that we think will really impact the representation of women. And they include the host of things that we work on, but we also want to acknowledge that there are a lot of other parts of the puzzle, that looking at how media are portrayed, women are portrayed in the media is important, and training women and funding women, all those things are also important. But we're focused specifically on those three structural things because we see them as the often overlooked and a pretty efficient way to get women into office. And so we, at this point, are reaching out to allied organizations, primarily in the women's representation community, just for the next few months. That will be our target audience. But we intend to, as I say, work with political parties and political action committees and donors, everybody who has a stake in leveling the playing field. We intend to help figure out what kind of targets to set and what kind of mechanisms we can adopt to elect more women.
So when you say the three structural changes, you're talking about ranked choice voting, about recruiting women, and about donors giving more money, or which three ones specifically?
The three that I like to emphasize the most are the recruitment and funding processes that will help more women run, the voting systems that will help more women win, or not help them win, enable them to win, and those internal legislative measures we spoke about, the child care and so forth, that will enable women to serve and lead effectively. Those are the three things.
That sounds like a great agenda.
Well, thank you. We hope so. believe so.
Yeah. How can our listeners help out and make some of these changes happen?
Yeah, well, we really are interested in working with people. We did we have a report that's available on our website, representation2020.com, and we sent this report out to thousands and thousands of legislators with a survey last year, and many of those elected officials have gotten involved and are interested in working at the local level in their city or state. So we have interested people waiting for activists and others to connect with them. We are interested in forming gender parity task forces in communities or on campuses, if you have some student listeners, to assess the landscape, figure out what the rules are, what the potential for change is, and then bringing resolutions to the campus or to the city council or whatever the legislative body is, resolutions around the recruitment and the voting systems and those internal legislative measures. So people can go to our website, representation2020.com. There's a pledge there, a gender parity pledge that people can sign. And the pledge includes several of the other things that we think are particularly important that I've already mentioned, the women in the media and the training and so forth. And people can contact us directly at representation2020.com to let us know they're interested. And if you people have questions, and we have we are developing a toolkit for people to use at the local level as well. So there's just all kinds of potential for involvement.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I notice you use the term gender parity and not gender equality. Are they the same, or how are they different?
I'm not a professional social scientist, so I may not really, I have my own definitions, I guess I'll say. And to me, parity, is really the balance that we're seeking, that both men and women over the course of a couple election cycles will be as likely to hold office. That's what we're seeking. It's not necessarily an equal outcome. We're not saying that we want women to be 51% of every legislative body all the time, but we're looking at a prolonged, not a snapshot, but a long angle, if you were to say, okay, over this 10-year period or two or three election cycles, women and men are as likely to hold elected office at all levels of government in every party across the country. That's our definition of gender parity. Equality to me seems more that I think relates or connects to the great efforts right now to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed and to think about women's economic equality and leveling the playing field in a number of other areas. But I think the parity reflects that balance and representation that we're after.
Yeah, so that's good. And I don't know that we're ever going to get to 50%. I mean, I think I know Rwanda's gotten there, but part of that is because there was so much internal fighting. A lot of the men killed each other. Mm. So there's a lot of women in office in Rwanda. But and I don't know that, you know, we don't necessarily need to mandate we have equality because, you know, a lot of women just don't like politics or don't want to get into that whole arena for a lot of very good reasons. But yeah, I think it should be as fair and likely for women to get in as men. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And how are you in your project Representation 2020? How are you going to measure your progress? And these are three great arenas you're talking about, recruitment and funding, voting reform, and the other kind of policy measures that allow women to serve and lead, like the child care, parental leave. That's a wonderful program. How are you going to measure your progress towards reaching parity and towards getting those measures adopted to get towards parity?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have a report that we've done twice now that that takes a look at all those areas that we work on to see how much progress is being made overall. And again, people can find that on the Representation 2020 website. It's the State of Women's Representation 2015-2016 report, and we've got chapters that are pretty in-depth on each of those reform areas that we've just talked about, the recruitment, the voting systems, and the internal legislative measures. So that's the big picture. We hope to do that every year, or at least every other year, to take stock and see how things are going and see where there's been progress and report on that progress. In order to really measure progress within the states, or among the states, we created something called the Gender Parity Index, and we gave points to each of the kinds of elected offices in a state, from the county level to the city level to state legislature, statewide executive office, and to congressional representation. And we created a tool to measure how each state is doing. So in our gender parity index, for example, we look at the three most recent gubernatorial elections, the most recent election for statewide elected office, the four most recent U.S. Senate elections, the most recent U.S. House election, the most recent state legislative election, and then the gender of speakers of the state House and Senate presidents and so forth, and then, as I say, the number of women mayors in all cities. And then and counties, I should say, each state is given a score, and right now, I don't know whether you want to have to guess on air which state is doing the worst and which is doing the best, but I'll just tell you. New Hampshire's doing the best. They're the only state to have gotten a score of 57, or have to broken the 50% threshold. And Mississippi is doing the worst on our index. It only has a 7%, or a score of 7 out of 50, so they have quite a bit of work to do.
Yeah, I would have guessed Mississippi is the worst. There's a number of states that aren't so bad, but it's exciting to me that it's New Hampshire there, live free or die state,
right,
is doing so well. I know they've had, you know, women U.S. senators, they even now, and have a woman governor of the state doing quite well. So it's really come a long way.
Yes.
So that's very interesting. And what do you say to those who oppose, gender parity or gender equality as women demanding special treatment? And I have to say, I have a nephew who lives in our number one state there now, New Hampshire, who's a liberal, a progressive Democrat. And I just read a Facebook posting from him yesterday where he basically is saying, what's all this women's equality garbage I hear about? It's just like, isn't this just women demanding special treatment? So what's your answer to that argument?
My answer is that we're just asking for a level playing field, nothing
mm-hmm.
more. And that there are structural obstacles to that level playing field, and that we've leveled the playing field for other groups of people. Just to circle back to what I was saying earlier, we recognize that there were structural obstacles for education and athletics for women, so we adopted Title IX and we adopted the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we've done thing after thing to level the playing field. So that's what we're assuming needs to be done for women's representation to flourish.
Yeah, you know, and it struck me as the same argument we heard about people asking for gay rights. And somewhere, I don't know where people get in their head that gay people were asking for special treatment. I mean, it never seemed that way to me. It just seemed to me gay people were saying, well, we deserve equal rights. We shouldn't be subjected to violence or to job discrimination simply on the basis of the fact of our, you know, being gay, and that seemed like a matter of basic fairness to me. So I'm not sure where this attack comes from. My guess is it's kind of being fed by some right-wing radio announcers.
Yes, and I think there's always a pushback. Whoever has the power is reluctant to just throw it around or put the ladder down, as it were. But I think there's growing consensus, certainly in the business community, as far as I understand, that these huge systems, whether it's Fortune 500 countries or representative bodies, just don't function as well unless everybody has a seat at the table. So it's well beyond just doing the right thing. It's the right thing for companies in order to be able to make a profit, for decisions to be able to be made, for the country to go forward, for us to adopt a budget. All those things require everybody to have a seat at the table. So I think that we're beyond the point where anybody can disregard the urgency of it. I think we're there. We need everybody. We need the best and the brightest, and we need to make sure there's no obstacle to anybody getting elected and serving effectively.
Right. That sounds good to me. And you've got a big agenda here. Who does Representation 2020 work on to try to advance your agenda for the gender parity?
Well, we're positioning ourselves right now as a resource for other groups in the women's representation community who are pushing also for greater increase in women's representation. So that's our primary audience right now. But frankly, I think there's just a lot of hunger out there in the country for new leadership in government. We just saw a new Speaker of the House today that's a reflection of that that thirst for new leadership, and I think a lot of our work can quench that thirst. I think there's a message that is very saleable to the people, and voters want it, and so I think we'll see more and more enthusiasm for these kinds of structural changes when people realize how easy it is to adopt them.
That sounds great. And do you have any final comment for our listeners before we sign off?
I guess my final comment is there are a lot of, it's a complicated problem, and it requires a complicated but strategic solution. And we're a part of that. We don't pretend to be the only thing. We do think, though, these structural changes haven't gotten enough attention, so that's why we're drawing attention to them now.
Great. And for our listeners who want to learn more about your work, they can go to representation2020.org.
Dot com.
And also fairvote.com, right?
Fairvote.org, yes.
Fairvote.org, there you go. That's
great.
All the time we have. Cynthia Terrell, thank you so much for being with us today, and thanks for all your important work for democracy.
Thank you, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about breakthrough solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.
Now that we know it, let's